You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is the kitchen of tomorrow, a press-button dream coming true for Mrs. Housewife.
The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live.
What is home? What is that sense of sacred space?
Hello, I'm Kurt Anderson here in Studio 360. Today, we look at a room in our lives where pretty much everything happens. The kitchen. From the stories we tell in it and about it, to the physical design of the space itself. My special guest today is the film director and writer and fabulous cook, Nora Ephron.
To me, the kitchen is mostly about food and, of course, family dinner in the kitchen.
All that and more ahead in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Every week in Studio 360, we explore one big idea at length, and in a few minutes, we'll look at the culture of the kitchen. But we also take time each week to talk about ideas and news currently rippling through the worlds of art and entertainment and design. But at this time of year, news and ideas of any kind are pretty much eclipsed by the output of the holiday industrial complex. It is now officially the holiday season. Happy holidays is what culturally sensitive, right-thinking Americans are supposed to say. That generic holidays, not Christmas, not Hanukkah, not Kwanzaa, is designed to maximize cheer and offend no one. Anything else would be considered too explicitly religious. We're a funny country that way. The holiday season has become an ever more intense, six-week, wall-to-wall, multimedia festival in America. Thanks both to our unrivaled piety and our unrivaled devotion to buying and selling stuff. No Western country is more religious nor more capitalist. But what really makes us feel most Christmassy? Sorry, I mean holiday-ish. Speaking for myself, the purely religious spectacles don't cut it. I find the giant menorahs and life-size churchyard creches and the rest all a little vulgar. And the purely commercial spectacles don't cheer me deeply either. Apart from private family rituals, I think that most people get their most intensely meaningful holiday jolts from our various seasonal art and entertainment rituals. The slightly manic and supernaturally tinged Christmas we celebrate was essentially invented in the 19th century. And we still cling today to classic 19th century cultural artifacts. Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker and Clement Clark Moore's 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, whether or not Clement Clark Moore actually wrote it, and Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol.
"Bah," said Scrooge. "Humbug."
It was 28 Decembers ago exactly that I had my own first glimmer of the spiritual. It was when I heard the hallelujah chorus of Handel's Messiah in a candlelit great hall. My epiphany had nothing to do with Jesus or with any other literal messianic faith. I am not now, nor have I ever been a Christian. But with the sheer, awesome, shocking blast of Handel's music at the end of a long winter's night. The cultural rituals that resonate most intensely and broadly, I think, the ones that provoke the greatest billions of goosebumps every December, are the narratives, the well-told stories that celebrate the virtues of generosity and faith, like a catechism class, but without a shred of religious doctrine, which is to say, in the movies. For all the moral corrosion attributed to Hollywood, the movies we watch at this time of year amount to mass spiritual instruction. Would we indulge such a sentimental celebration of generosity, family love, and faith at any other time of the year? I make a point of sitting through It's a Wonderful Life every year around now, and, like clockwork, sob every time I do.
"Merry Christmas, you wonderful old Billy and Lone!"
So many of the movies we crowd into at this time of year are essentially religious tales, parables of ordinary sinners being miraculously resurrected.
"You hate Christmas.
You're going to steal it.
The Grinch is a big, flashy, $100 million commercial apparatus, sure. But it's also a moving story of a sinner's revelation and miraculous redemption. How about the new Bruce Willis movie, Unbreakable?
Why are you looking at me like that?
Suffering, supernatural revelation, and miraculous redemption.
You don't have a scratch on you.
And this year's Tom Hanks film, Castaway, it'll be released 3 days before Christmas. Yes, more suffering and more miraculous redemption. Back in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, painters and composers were expected to create work with explicitly religious themes. In the 21st century, in the civilized world, religious faith is walled off from art and entertainment. Filmmakers are expected only to sell tickets. What's interesting is that a lot of them are doing so by creating religious movies that pretend not to be, especially now around Christmas time. I mean, the holidays. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Regularly here in Studio 360, we explore design for the real world. Why the things we use every day look and feel the way they do, from thermostats to Post-it notes to Tupperware. This week, graphic designer Leslie Smolin talks about her passion for something you may be using this very instant to stir your coffee. The spoon.
It's just got this beauty and elegance regardless of the translation. So here I have what is a salt spoon, but it's so perfectly formed and it's got all the quality and character of a larger version. I mean, and I contrast that small one with, you know, a big wooden stirring spoon or, a, you know, if you envision a spoon to stir a cauldron, you know, that a witch might have. The scale changed from one to another, and yet it still retains its essential spoonness. The spoons can be made out of almost any material we think of. They're plastic, wood, bone, horn, ivory, steel, aluminum, iron, paper, glass. And then there's certainly lots of other things you can do to change it. The bowl shape can be deepened to make a ladle. The size of the bowl can be adjustable. As in measuring spoons, you know, where you kind of integrate a mathematical component, so they feel so machined and precise and have that quality, and obviously there's plastic versions, but I love this metal version with a little ring so that they stay together. It does connote a certain level of precision, and then when you think of cooking, it seems like such an artful expression. But a lot of good chefs, if you talk to them, a lot of it's about organization ahead of time and really making sure you have all your materials and knowing the chemistry of how to balance out one taste with another. Another variation in spoons could be the handles. In this case, I've got a baby spoon. It literally says baby. It's carved into the handle, and the handle's curved around so the child really can grab it as they would a rattle. They also, the silver ones, get this great patina. I think all of them, there's something about an object that you use every single day. It just has this incredible wear and tear, but they hold up, and the patina that comes from usage seems to give it character. Mm-hmm. They almost have an anthropomorphic feeling to them because they are so well designed for the hand, you know, and really works as an extension of your arm. Both my husband and I have a number of silver pieces we've inherited from our grandparents. He got me hooked on collecting silver. So I like them when they're kind of worn and used and you know that they've been handed down. But that whole sense of someone else owning it and it being a kind of personal artifact that then is passed on and used. Not, I have jewelry home that was my grandmother's that I have no idea when to wear. And yet these are the kinds of pieces that I could live with and use and serve and think about her every time I use it. In some ways, I think, like a lot of other craft aspects, it's a lost art, which is sad to lose.
that's designed for the real world. Do you have some everyday item you're curious about? You can write to us through our website, studio360.org, or mail us a letter at Studio 360, WNYC, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're going to start a new regular feature that we're calling Artist's Choice, where we ask artists to talk about the particular music or painting or film or other work of art that is their inspiration or their solace. I spoke recently with the novelist Susanna Moore, the author of My Old Sweetheart, The Whiteness of Bones, and In the Cut. Susanna is enthralled by the music of Cuban singer Antonio Machim.
1949, I think, was his prime, and it didn't last very long. 1949 to 1952.
Do you speak Spanish?
I do.
So when you hear it, you don't love it simply because it's romantic in some indecipherable way.
Understanding the words in a way makes it, I was going to say more shameful because it's so nostalgic and romantic. And in some ways, maybe listening to the words makes it...
You feel a little embarrassed for liking something so treacly?
It actually makes me happy as well, and happy tinged with a kind of melancholy and a kind of longing.
Yo sé que algún día, sin esperarlo, yo me de enamorar.
I often listen to music when I'm working, almost always, which surprises people because a lot of friends of mine who are writers can't. And I tend to listen to Machim quite often, and I think it has to do with a kind of nostalgia. When I hear the music, I think of our parents' generation. It's a little bit like movie music, and it's full of gardenias. I imagine a kind of decadent Cuba. I mean, women on the dance. It's like a kind of Spanish-speaking Fred Astaire for me. I do think that music locates itself particularly in time. I mean, I can remember the period when I read, say, a certain novel or a certain book. I can remember absolutely where I was and what I was doing. But music, I think, does it so much more intensely because the proof is I'm having a memory of something that didn't even happen to me.
Thank you, Susanna Moore, for introducing me to the music of Antonio Machim.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now to explore the cult and culture of the kitchen.
Dear Schlup was in Seattle. You're the most attractive man I ever laid ears on.
Wait, wait, wait. They called? How did they get our number? Oh, let me guess. You gave it to them.
You have to give them your phone number. They won't let you on the air. Dear Sleepless in Seattle, I live in Tulsa. Where's that?
It's in Oklahoma. Do you know where Oklahoma is?
Somewhere in the middle.
I'm not even going to think about what they're not teaching you in school. I'm not going to think about it. Yeah, somewhere in the middle. And generally speaking, I think we should rule out anyone that doesn't live near here.
That clip is from the film Sleepless in Seattle with the Tom Hanks character and the actor playing his son in the kitchen of their home. Life happens in the kitchen in this country a lot, and life in the kitchen is a rich subject for designers and artists and novelists, even poets and filmmakers, including my special guest today, Nora Ephron, who wrote and directed Sleepless in Seattle, among many other delightful movies, and with whom we're going to explore the kitchen as symbol and icon, as creative venue, and as a convenient place to stage fictional scenes. Welcome to Studio 360, Nora Ephron.
Thank you.
That scene from Sleepless, if I can call it Sleepless, could have taken place anywhere. Could it not have? And I wonder.
Sure, absolutely.
Why did you choose to set it in the kitchen?
Well, I don't know. It just seemed that entire set, the inside of that houseboat, was built so that it was one flowing space. But the truth was that almost every time we did anything in the space, it ended up in the kitchen because there's something to do in a kitchen.
You're chopping or you're putting pots in the oven.
Or you're cooking. I mean, it's not like a living room which is a kind of room where we don't quite know what we're meant to do in it. Live is what we're meant to do in it, but no one knows what that is. So we all end up gravitating toward the rooms that have functions, like the bedroom. We know what we're supposed to do in the bedroom. We know what we're supposed to do in the room with the TV in it, which is usually not the living room if you have more than one room for living. And then, of course, the kitchen, where there's more to do than almost anything, because you can not only cook in the living room, you can in the kitchen, you can eat in the kitchen.
So dialogue in a movie or in a book even can take place in a kind of sidelong, glancing way while chopping and boiling are occurring.
Yes, and you can actually hear, if you were listening, you can hear Tom Hanks flipping a hamburger in that scene.
A lot of your films are, in fact, most of them are set in sort of intimate domestic settings. Sleepless in Seattle, as we talked about, but When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail. That seems to be a fairly rare venue these days for the feature film to take place. We're in the age of huge special effects and sort of flagrantly moronic comedies. Do you find yourself being a kind of endangered species? Or your
I mean, you're talking about the home, really, as
not
opposed to the office or the munitions factory or whatever, but the battlefield.
I'm waiting for your munitions film.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it myself. But I think that whether or not that's true about movies, it is not true at all about television. Almost all television shows take place in the home. And when you go onto a television set and you see the kind of sprawling set, the kitchen is always the center of it, the biggest part of it, the most cubic footage. I mean, we're always kind of flabbergasted when we see these kitchens because in our wildest dreams, none of us has kitchens that are quite this big.
Although I think those television kitchens actually have become the model that people with the wherewithal to afford it model their kitchens after.
Maybe, but it's still hard to one of the things that always fascinates me is that they all face the audience, everything in them, you know, all the seating areas.
The big hit sitcoms of the last few years, like Seinfeld and Friends, the kitchen is there in the shot all the time.
Yes, exactly.
You are also, Nora Ephron, an amazing cook yourself, in addition to all of your other many
achievements. This is true. I want to say that.
I should just say
thank you or aw shucks. But the truth is I do love cooking.
And when you cook, do you concentrate fully on the process of cooking, or is this in your busy days, a still place where you can have ideas for movies and books and things?
No, I think I've written this. One of the things I think is so great about cooking is that unlike what one does all day, which is problematical and difficult and is it going to work and all of those other questions, you do have a certain mathematical certainty about cooking. You know that if you do X plus Y, the sauce will get thick. And you know that if you cook something this amount of time, it will be done and all of that stuff. So I find it a kind of brain, you know, it's sort of restful, really. I mean, whenever people say cooking is very creative, I always go, I don't think so, you know.
It does have that auteurist ability to have this self-contained thing that you create in a period of time and give to the world and applaud.
And it's good. And it's good. And sometimes you can do something sort of amazing that just astonishes everyone, but I don't really confuse it with, like, you know,
creativity.
Creativity, yeah.
Nora Ephron, we have a whole bunch of interesting stories ahead about the kitchen, about a book about the design of the kitchen over the last 100 years and how it reflects our cultural, social mores, how the kitchen has responded to and molded family life. We'll look also at the design of the stuff we buy to stick in our kitchens, and we'll look at how the exquisite ordinariness of kitchens have even inspired poets and artists, in addition to yourself. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with me and my guest Nora Ephron in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it. Babies teeth at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. At this table we gossip, recall enemies and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor falling down selves and as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table, while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite.
That was poet Joy Harjo reading from her poem, Perhaps the World Ends Here. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with film director Nora Ephron, and we're talking all about the culture of the kitchen. Nora, is the kitchen as spiritually and emotionally charged for you as that, as the center of life? Because for me, I have to admit, it really isn't such a sacred place.
To me, the kitchen is mostly about food and, of course, family dinner in the kitchen. I have enormous pride in my kitchen, mostly in what's in my refrigerator. I consider my refrigerator the sort of modern equivalent of Fibber McGee's closet. I want you to be able to open my refrigerator and have everything just fall out. There's so much in it.
Do you have a big industrial strength, professional, sub-zero, 10-foot by 8-foot apparatus, or do you have a normal refrigerator?
No, I have the sub-zero. I have a Viking stove.
Well, that was my next question.
I mean, it's...
Which is the sort of professional restaurant quality stove.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, where you get to a certain point in your life where if you have to buy a stove for a little bit more, you can have the best stove there is and everything cooks better on it and everything. So it's the thing that says, I'm a little bit serious about this.
And things like your Viking stove and Sub-Zero refrigerator are just the latest episode in the transformation of the American kitchen over the last century. Elizabeth Cromley, who is the chair of the Art and Architecture Program at Northeastern University, is finishing a book on American kitchens from colonial times to the present. And she spoke recently with Studio 360's Julie Burstein about what kitchens tell us about how American lives have been transformed.
The American kitchen hasn't always been a center of family life, or even of culinary life. In fact, there hasn't always been a kitchen as we know it. Elizabeth Cromley says that in the early days of our country, a family kept its food everywhere. Potatoes in the root cellar, beef in the smokehouse, cheeses in the bedroom. It wasn't until the 19th century that rooms began having a single purpose. And even then, it depended on what class you were. In tenement houses at the turn of the century, for instance, there was just one central room called living room.
From the working class side, there's a long history of a kind of bigger room where the cooking is done, the stove is located, the sink is there, the kids are hanging out, and people were even sleeping there because it was warmer, because cooking was being done, and that was a warm room, so you could go to sleep.
At the other end of the scale, members of an upper-class family would spend very little time in the kitchen, which was the domain of the servants.
The mistress of the household would, negotiate with the cook about what they were going to have for dinner, but she wouldn't spend a lot of time there. And so kitchens were elaborated at the top end into lots of rooms. You know, there'd be a big pantry, a serving pantry of some kind, a room in which the servants would eat their meals, a walk-in refrigerator, you know, and then kind of the main room where you'd have the sink and the stove.
A middle-class kitchen of the same period was so tightly organized that a cook could just stand in one place and revolve to reach all the appliances.
The old ideal for the middle-class kitchen comes from early 20th century home economics, sort of household improvers who thought that everything to do with the kitchen should be in one room, and the one room should be relatively small, and storage should be very well thought out so that there'd be a cabinet or a shelf for every single thing.
This is the kitchen of tomorrow, a press-button dream coming true for Mrs. Housewife. All sorts of wonders are hers at the push of a button, from refrigerator doors to countertops built for big gals or little gals. Don't have to lean over here, you see? What's for dinner?
By the 1950s, the middle-class kitchen was domestic headquarters for the homemaker. And architects began to think that she shouldn't be stuck in the back corner of the house, but should be able to participate in the social life of the household. And so they began breaking down the walls.
In, say, Frank Lloyd Wright, an American architect who was designing smaller houses in the 1930s, he starts to make the walls of the kitchen out of glass shelves. So the housewife isn't blocked away behind the wall, but can see through the wall and see through the glass shelves and kind of participate in what's going on in the next room. So there's a movement to get the housewife out of her cage and bring her back into the social activity of the house.
Today, that openness has been expanded, and kitchens are being built with room for couches and fireplaces. They're not just kitchens, but a kind of family room with a stove.
You see the presumption that when guests come over, they're all going to cook. Everybody's going to participate in producing the meal. Which is really interesting because in the early 20th century, that's exactly what you couldn't imagine doing. The guests were in the dining room, and if the housewife was preparing the meal, she was doing it all undercover so that nobody would see any mess or smell any smells, and the food should appear, you know, the sort of immaculate conception of the dinner. So the guests would never be part of any of that preparation. And now the kitchen's become, you know, kind of like a theater where people are watching the food preparation and they're taking hand in it. And the open kitchen is, it's a performance. Food production is a performance for your friends.
Whatever the size of the kitchen, it's a pretty sure bet that whenever there's a party, it's where people gather.
People of our generation think about the kitchen as the place where your mommy will be. And so there is a kind of a comfort sort of thing about coming home from school and going to the kitchen and looking for your mommy and having your milk and cookies. And that maybe just kind of lasts in the back of your mind. You think the kitchen is a comfort place.
Kitchen kisses are the kind that come from a happy, contented family. Enjoy them every day.
In Studio 360, I'm Julie Burstein.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the director and writer Nora Ephron, talking about the culture of the kitchen. We've just heard from architectural historian Elizabeth Cromley. Nora, is the kitchen still regarded as the one place in the house where the woman is still in control? Because I'm the cook in my household, but I wonder if it's still generally considered a female place.
Well, I think it is, but I think it's starting very... I mean, I only know in my own home that my husband can cook and sometimes does. So I feel as if in some slow, slurpy way, men are getting more into the kitchen, although most of the time it's a kind of recreational thing that they think they deserve a medal for.
Do you go shopping yourself?
I actually do the thing that most people in New York do, which is that I sometimes go shopping and sometimes I call someone at a store and order things on the phone. I mean, that's one of the true pleasures of New York life is how little shopping you have to do for almost everything.
Although New Yorkers are deprived of that real pleasure, and I mean this sincerely, the occasional hour spent in a great, wonderful, huge supermarket.
That's true. But there is the Price Club. I hope you have been to the Price Club.
Never.
The Price Club is beyond your wildest dreams because, first of all, you have this cart that is about as big as a room. It's so huge. And we always go in there, and $200 later, we come out. We go in intending to spend $23, and you cannot help yourself. You must have the giant thing of Advil. It is just shouting at you. And you not only get the unbelievable pleasure of buying these things, but then you get this added bang when you get home and you can run madly through your home comparing what you paid for the very large thing with what you paid for the unbelievably tiny thing at your local supermarket. It's a thrilling experience, like booster rockets of pleasure.
And the supermarket is this incredibly seductive sort of hall of design, museum of products. And so we invited my friend Stephen Doyle, who's a top graphic designer, and his wife Gail Towie, who is Martha Stewart's principal creative mastermind and creative director, to go with me on a tour not of Price Club, but of the King Supermarket in Short Hills, New Jersey. We started somewhere between Tostitos and Golden Grahams. You look at the chips, both potato chips, corn chips, there's a certain vocabulary of that product packaging. It doesn't matter if it's who it's made by, there's a certain sort of similarity. We look across the aisle at cereals, similarly, several different companies, but this different product that has its own what? Vocabulary of how you design a cereal package. How does that get started? Does some guy do that, or woman, create the first Corn Pops package and then all cereals follow because that's what cereal boxes are supposed to look like?
You know, they say that a lot of the cereal boxes are designed for children, and if the children are shopping with the mom, then they can recognize their favorite cartoon characters and the sort of colorful qualities, whereas the cereals for adults on the top shelf are much more restrained. Healthy Choice looks definitely more serious, less cartoonish.
It's interesting. Smart Start looks a little bit more like an income tax form than a box of cereal.
I think people are able to, or must be able to, process so many different messages simultaneously, and there's a certain confidence that the designers have in giving you about five or six messages simultaneously. And the fact that we can process all that in a breezy sort of walk down the aisle is really says a lot about us as people.
And, you know, people have talked about and talk about the density of messages of MTV, of the
right.
Quick cuts. And but my gosh, a supermarket aisle, given the, you know, 2 miles an hour at which you walk, the number of messages that are sort of jammed into your brain is amazing.
Now the produce pickup on line one, count line one.
The Special K, now that is a cool packaging. It's the traditional half-gallon milk container, plasticized cardboard container, but it's full of Special K cereal.
It is interesting to me as a designer that somebody has leapt out of the rectangular box within the cereal aisle context and put a cereal into basically a milk carton as a way to differentiate it and send that signal of, oh, you know, here's, don't forget the milk, it's a breakfast thing.
It's healthy, it's a kind of commodity product, but it's special and it's healthy.
It's got a reclosable lid. It looks like the stuff is going to stay nice and fresh. It looks like it's fresh just because it looks like milk. It looks like it's dated material, and this is new. This is not the old cereal that's been in the closet for a while.
So it's like driving down a strip, a highway, and seeing basically the identical cubic building with different signs on it, and suddenly you see a real building that is built, has different architecture. That's what this Special K thing sort of jumps out.
And where the architecture delivers a message, it really does deliver a punch. The shape of the box itself has a story to tell. I'm looking for the missing children on the side of it now.
And of course they're selling Noxzema lotion on the side of it, which is a sort of the number of sort of mixed metaphors between cereal and milk and Noxzema lotion.
And feel your best with Special K cereal and Noxzema. It doesn't say how to mix them together, actually.
It seems to me, as other areas of the supermarket aisles given food sectors have expanded, Campbell's Soup is sort of small.
But you know, they've tricked you. Everybody's looking at this stuff and saying the classic Campbell's Soup can, and this is completely different from the Campbell's Soup can that Andy Warhol memorialized.
Because it's sort of tarted up and decorated, as opposed to that very simple, iconic white lettering on red that used to be
all typographic. Now the gold medallion has shrunken and it's risen to the top. It used to be in the middle of the can, separating the red band from the white. The typeface has gotten all funky.
It looks nice, though. It's all sort of perfectly lined up. Every single bowl is exactly the same. And your reference is as much in the picture as it is in the type.
We're looking at the old-fashioned cans, but right next to it is now there's Campbell's Simply Home Soup in a Jar, where you can actually see the soup itself, which is maybe not such a good idea. It is terrifying looking.
Well, but it is obviously meant to be homemade, like, you know, the tomato sauce that your mom or your grandmother put up, or the jellies that they put up, because they're in that sort of mason jar.
No, it makes me want to buy it. I've never seen it, and
It actually looks like real food.
Joseph J.O.S., abbreviated Joseph A. Campbell, is stamped in the glass at the top of the jar, like a mason jar has stamping, and it gives it that sense of authenticity.
I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, guaranteed personality.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with writer and director Nora Ephron. Nora, do you respond when you're in a supermarket to stuff like that Campbell's soup in an old-fashioned mason jar and other mass merchandise products that try to recreate a sense of small batch, old-time 1920s or 19th century packaging? Or are you cynical enough to think, no, they're trying to appeal to my sense of the good old days and I won't buy?
Oh, no, I am it. I am your swing state when that stuff happens. I respond to it absolutely.
Gail, who was joined there by her husband, Stephen, in the supermarket in Short Hills, New Jersey, is in some sense the brains behind Martha Stewart. Are you a Martha Stewart follower, or do you find that you're sort of, you were there by yourself and you don't need her to worship her
as other women do. Actually do worship her. I think she's sort of amazing. I really do. And I'm hooked on the magazine, completely hooked on it. And I've been interested for a long time in the whole thing that has been happening, because when the women's movement came along and the little woman was kind of denigrated as a dream of any sort, it became a problem for media, because so much of American media is based on selling food. So how could you get women to go on wanting to cook? And one of the things I think was done by the newspapers and by Craig Claiborne and by, you know, not by Julia Child on purpose doing this, but she served as a way to make women think that cooking was something you did if you were smart and college educated.
In a moment, we're going to hear about an artist who's taken the idea of kitchens generally to a kind of dreamy, surreal, staggeringly beautiful extreme. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with me as I continue to explore the cult and culture of the kitchen with my special guest, Nora Ephron, here in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the writer and director Nora Ephron. We're talking about how the kitchen has inspired stories and paintings and TV shows and poems, like this one by Marge Piercy. It's called What's That Smell in the Kitchen?
All over America, women are burning dinners. It's lamb chops in Peoria. It's haddock in Providence. It's steak in Chicago. Tofu delight in Big Sur. Red rice and beans in Dallas. All over America, women are burning food they're supposed to bring with calico smile on platters glittering like wax. Anger sputters in her brain pan, confined but spewing out missiles of hot fat. Her life is cooked and digested, nothing but leftovers and Tupperware. Look, she says, once I was roast duck on your platter with parsley, but now I am spam. Burning dinner is not incompetence, but war.
I think it's true that if your marriage goes bad, you probably don't feel like cooking. I mean, I get that, but that's about what I get about it.
But sort of 35 years...
Dishes are a big thing, don't
I
you
know.
Think?
Well, they are. It's why the great, so far tenable division of labor in my household is I cook and she cleans the dishes. The dishes, to my way of thinking, being the horrible chore in any household.
But, if you have the confusion of food and love, which I certainly do happily... Things like that poem are a little teeny bit mystifying.
There's this wonderful young artist, Liza Liu, who's captured a bit of that Marge Piercy anger, as well as a lot of beauty and playfulness and fascination, in an extraordinary work that she simply calls Kitchen. It's actually a 200-square-foot kitchen made out of intensely colored tiny glass beads. It's brighter than life and playful and surreal with a kind of Marcel Duchampian edge. There's a beaded fridge, a beaded stove, an open oven with beaded girly dancers inside on the back, and a sink full of dirty dishes and dishwater that's beaded to look just like the blue and white swirls in the sky in Van Gogh's Starry Night. Reporter Robin Yurevich has this story on Liza Liu's kitchen, as well as her latest work, which is called Homette.
I must make up my mind today.
It's a 1949 Spartan mobile mansion, a trailer parked at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Everything except for the ceiling is covered in beads. You pull open a velvet curtain and enter the scene of a black and white film noir.
You're in the Hollywood movie because it's completely sparkly. It's completely what you think of as movies.
Thank you, Betty.
Thank you, Mr. Stroud. I certainly wish I could find that picture.
You're also in a man's house. In the living room, it looks like he's just kicked off a pair of boots and socks. The remains of dinner are on the coffee table, along with a crushed Marlboro box and a half pint of Jack Daniels. Their logos are perfectly drawn in beads. Guns, also beaded, are everywhere. There's a Spartan kitchen, a table and benches, and an old manual typewriter with crumpled papers and a note that reads, "Keep your eyes on the road to liberty." You peek into the bedroom through an open door, just enough to see a man's leg on the floor, a gun, and another bottle of Jack Daniels next to it.
You? It's not what you think it is. Take it easy. Keep calm. This is somebody's been murdered, that's all.
Murdered?
The great cathedrals of Europe are an unlikely inspiration for this piece. But that's where Liza Liu says she got the idea to recreate a trailer home.
I went to Rome. I was looking at chapels. So I went from thinking about sacred places to the domestic sphere, thinking about the altar at home, that kind of, you know, what is home? What is that sense of sacred space, you know, that private sacred space?
10 years ago, Liza Liu was a painter, just 20 years old, with a full scholarship to the San Francisco Art Institute. She wandered into a bead store, left with a few bags full, and the idea that she'd found her medium. She began beading her paintings, an experiment that her teachers hated.
For some reason, what I was doing looked terrible to everyone, and it probably was terrible. And I was just inspired to keep kind of exploring the medium.
Liu left school, a failure, as she puts it, and spent the next 5 years creating a full-size 200-square-foot beaded kitchen. Reading about women's lives and listening to music that inspired her, Liza Liu built and painted every piece, except for a few real-life objects like the discarded oven she picked up off the street. And she developed a technique for using glue and tweezers to cover the painted surfaces with tiny beads. The work is brilliantly colorful and sparkling, the stereotypical American kitchen of the 1950s or 60s.
It was the fantasy of women who maybe got married and expected their lives to be glowy and, you know, happy. I wanted it to look like all those kind of collective dreams, that kind of fantasy of the perfect life.
There are cereal boxes whose perfectly rendered logos scream just a little louder than the real thing. bright yellow pats of butter on perfect slices of white toast, shimmering sugar frosted flakes and flaky pies bursting with purple beaded berries paint a daydream environment. But the fantasy wasn't enough for a lot of women like Liza's grandmother. This work is a tribute to women like her.
I hoped that I was. I hoped that I was making a piece that was honored women's work, honored the tradition of, you know, my grandmother, for example, who didn't actually like baking pies. She was really bitter about that. You know, she wasn't a pie-baking grandma. She was a writer. She was a frustrated artist, and she never got her due. You know, she worked her life raising her kids and never realized her own personal dreams. I wanted to honor these women who might have been great, might have been great artists, but didn't have the chance. They had to wash the dishes. So I wanted to make these dishes so beautiful that it would make your eyes hurt. You know, I wanted to make the floors permanently sparkling, that if women have had to give up their ambitions or dreams historically for, you know, the prosaic, for the everyday, I wanted a monument to it.
Lou embroidered this Emily Dickinson poem in beads on the kitchen's oven.
She rose to his requirement, dropped the playthings of her life to take the honorable work of woman and of wife. I love this poem because if a woman gave up everything she was to become a housewife, the husband gets to know how great she is. The world doesn't.
The kitchen's about toiling in obscurity, as Liza Lou did when she was creating this piece. 2 years into Kitchen, a part of it, an entire breakfast table, made it into a juried show.
I met the juror, and the juror was this artist that I really admired. And he said to me, you know, I really love your work. This is really great, but you didn't win anything. And it was this moment where I was still waitressing. I didn't have any money. I had rented a car, my last dime, you know, to actually a van to take the piece up. So I remember driving the van home just completely beside myself, just totally destroyed, you know, just beyond destroyed. Which sounds kind of melodramatic now when I think about it. But at that moment, it was everything to me. It was like this was my first, you know, show ever. And so I made this newspaper.
Its headline says, Housewife Beads the World. It now sits on the breakfast table. Liza Lou imagines a husband coming downstairs to a magnificently beaded kitchen. He notices nothing and casually picks up the paper.
So the newspaper is meant to be kind of like, you can bead the whole world. You can make a monument that is the size of, you know, Kilimanjaro. You can make something. You can, you know, do backflips and cartwheels, and you can sing songs and toot horns and cover the whole world in the most magnificent materials, but there's always going to be someone who hates it. So I wanted to kind of reference that in this piece, and I continued making it. But in the piece, there's this kind of little aside that, you know, no matter what, someone's, you know, it's not about winning anyone's approval.
Liza Lou finished the kitchen in marathon beading sessions between day jobs. Now she works in a big open studio adjoining her house in the canyon between the beach and the San Fernando Valley. Her art is still all-consuming, so her own domestic life remains a fantasy. As for her own kitchen,
this is a complete mess. That's why you can't come inside. I've got dishes inside the sink that don't look like, you know, they're the gray, weird mystery bits floating. I've been on a deadline, so, I mean, everything goes to pot.
For Studio 360, I'm Robin Jurevich.
Nora Ephron, it's interesting. I've find myself in awe of this work. And it's interesting to me that it simultaneously really does celebrate and embrace the kitchen and the craft that is this traditional feminine craft, but it simultaneously has this sort of satirical edge. And it's interesting to me that, as we've talked about today, that it's sort of she represents having gone from the thesis, if you will, of old-fashioned Leave It to Beaver kitchens to the rage of the 60s and 70s. This is very, for lack of a better word, very now. This kind of complicated take on the kitchen could only be a product of the current moment, where we both adore, you know, the way that Martha Stewart presents a potential domestic world, even as we occasionally, you know, look at that whole idea with a gimlet eye.
Yeah, I'm not entirely. I mean, I'm crazy about Liza Lou. I think she's brilliant. I'm not quite sure what she's, you know, when she talks about the, you know, the forgotten homemaker who deserves a kind of celebration of her
heroic, anonymous work.
Heroic. And then I think, well, you know, is that yet another way to make women think that there's something heroic about the drudgery of blah, 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 of their role, of their responsibility? I don't know. I can't get into that. I mean, I just love that kitchen because I think it is divine and gorgeous.
Well, here we are in that kind of wonderful moment between Thanksgiving and Christmas when the sort of each of us in our homes puts on the greatest kitchen show on earth. Do you think that's harder for people to sort of summon up the requisite will to do the whole turkey stuffing pies thing, or do we still sort of regard that as a sacred obligation?
I actually think that in my house it's probably the most religious thing that goes on. The ritual of Thanksgiving dinner and the rituals of Christmas. I get pretty stupid about this stuff. I mean, baking cookies for the tree and stuff like that with everyone's name on them. And I do that, you know.
And are they allowed? Are they eaten, or they just become?
They're both eaten, and they're on the tree. I mean, I make enough so that you can eat some and see some and all of the rest of it. But I just love that. And there are occasional Christmases when life intervenes and I don't do it all. And I always feel a little bit sad if that happens. But I feel as if that's a way for those of us who aren't particularly religious to celebrate family and to celebrate that thing we believe in, friends and all of that. And there you are with those good smells in the kitchen, you know, the cinnamon smell, which is just this time of year.
And it becomes the high holy days for we secular humanists, I guess.
Well, I think so. And I think we celebrate it with, you know, with the question of the stuffings and, and I always think, I mean, I think that one of the things we do to our children is give them a very clear idea of what those dinners are meant to consist of so that they are on some level ruined forever for alternative experiences, and God help them if they marry someone with equally strong ideas about it.
Well, indeed, I remember the perhaps the greatest, most ferocious battle that ever took place in my family household when I and my three siblings were young adults, and two of my siblings had become, among other things, strict vegetarians. And the discussion over whether or not an actual fowl could be cooked sort of went so deeply to exactly what you're talking about, is this is the way that this practice of ritual food eating is done.
Yes, I think that when one's children become vegetarians, which is an inevitability at some point, the question is it permanent or just a glitch there? It's very rattling to the entire functioning of the household. And I remember when my older son became a vegetarian, it was right around the time that Barbara Bush was the first lady, and she had gotten up somewhere.
As opposed to Queen Mother, I guess. Is
well, whatever. She was up there saying things, and one of the things she said was, I don't know what a family is, but, and then she went on and on and on. And that became a kind of sort of bromide of the period, I don't know what a family is. And I sat there thinking, I know exactly what a family is. A family is a group of people who sits down and eats the same thing every night. And it's what's so rattling about vegetarianism is that suddenly there's someone in the house who is refusing to eat what everyone else eats. It's like a knife in the heart of the family. Fortunately, in the case of my home, my older son came to what we regard as his senses and now eats birds
flesh
and things. Yes, right. But I think that is such a very powerful sense of what we are as a family. And when your children grow up and come home and say those words you just love to hear, oh, please make the fill in the blank, the roast beef or the chicken with the sausage, whatever it is in your home, you feel in some way that whatever other mistakes you've made as a family, you have at least done this thing right, even though it's just a pathetic way of looking at yourself.
Nora Ephron, it has been great having you here in Studio 360 today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Kurt Anderson. We're going to end the show today in a small, sunny kitchen and office 20 stories above Washington Square in Greenwich Village, where food stylist Rick Ellis has assembled a sort of culinary time machine through the vehicle of his enormous cookbook collection. His first finds have ultra-colored covers and kitschy titles like Cooking for Orgies and Saucepans and the Single Girl. We asked Rick Ellis to take us to a kitchen of another century by making a recipe from his favorite cookbook.
I can't say I have a favorite. Not with 5,000 books or thereabouts. The Virginia housewife, Karen Hess, great food historian, feels that it's probably the most authentic early American cookbook in terms of really representing American cuisine, published in 1824 in Virginia. Wonderful recipes, great reading. And I was flipping through, trying to pick something that I thought would be easy to talk about and demonstrate. And what caught my eye about it was, it's a classic apple pie, peeled apple sliced thinly. She says lay a crust into the bottom of your pie plate. Alternate layers of what she calls powdered sugar, which of course would refer to just finely ground sugar. Sugar came in blocks or cones, and they had to grind it themselves, but not what we think of as confectioner sugar. She then is seasoning it, which is the part that I found interesting, with rose water sprinkled over the top and a few whole cloves. And that's a combination that I'd never seen before, and I love rose water, and I thought, might be very interesting. So, since I don't need much of an excuse to make a pie anyhow, I thought I would give that one a whirl.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Jan Werner,
Lital Malad,
Andy Lancet,
Susan Morris, consultant.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson. Join us next week when we'll talk about the interactions of culture and medicine. We'll be exploring whether plastic surgeons should be considered artists, and whether genetically altered glow-in-the-dark bunny rabbits should be considered art. All that and much more next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, the Eleanor Naylor Dana Charitable Trust, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.